Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network.
I'm ready to blow it, just one more sound.
Brain Injury Radio and Radio Ability are sponsored by the TBI Network.
Find them on facebook.com/TBI Network or at tbifn.org.
Brain Injury Radio is on 7 nights a week, and now, for tonight's episode of Brain Injury Radio.
Brain Injury Month. Brain Injury Awareness Month. And Surviving a Trauma with Terry Smith and Michelle. Hi, Michelle.
Hey, Terry. How are you today?
Oh, it's good to be back another month here. Welcome, welcome to everybody listening, and you, Michelle. And this is a special month for us, Brain Injury Awareness Month, to get a little bit more attention for our silent epidemic. How are you?
Yeah, no complaints. I'm just getting ready for another trip. I'll be away part of next week, going to Denver. So it'll be nice and frosty.
Well,
40 degrees for the high.
Every month, you're in a different adventure, so that's good. You're keeping yourself busy.
Oh yes, I tried to. That's my goal. I like to learn something new, do something different once a month somewhere. I mean, what? Why not?
Why not? When we can do it, we should do it. Well, let's welcome our audience again for another month. Whether you're listening live, morning, noon, or night, wherever you are on our planet, or you're listening to an archived show, we send you lots of love and hopefully inspiration with our conversation tonight. We're going to have a special guest tonight calling us, hopefully. Cher Wilson is going to reach us tonight, and we will hear from her a little bit later in the segment. But we'd like to thank our network owner, Craig Cecilia, who pays all the bills around here and makes sure that we're giving our voice to the silent epidemic. And Kim Justice, our network manager, who schedules all of our shows and hosts and all the various shows throughout the week. Every night of the week, there's a show on Brain Injury Radio Network talking about some type of trauma for the head. And we tonight are going to discuss Brain Injury Awareness Month, Alzheimer's, and a special shout out to people who want to share their stories, like Cher Wilson tonight is going to call us and share her story. And we'd like to give everyone the opportunity to call us by dialing, if you're out of the United States, outside of the United States, the country code is 1. If you're here inside the United States, the area code is 424-243-9545. And once you're in queue and you'd like to speak, press 1 on your phone, and then we'll see a little emoji go up on the switchboard and bring you on air. So again, welcome. Thank you for listening. And we'd like to get started with a hand on the switchboard already. We have, in fact, let me look at the phone number. I think it's our guest. It's the phone number for Cher. Our guest is starting early tonight, so we will get Cher on the line and get started.
She's early,
but we'll get started. We'll jump right in, live, all the way live. Here we go. And in 1 second, we'll have her on the air. Hello, Cher. Welcome to Surviving Head Trauma.
Hi there. Well, thank you for having me call in.
Well, welcome. How are you this evening?
I'm not bad. Better than nothing, as I say often.
Yeah, it's always good to say that we're grateful for what we have, and that's what you sound like you said. So congratulations for that positive attitude. We need more of that. And for our audience, Cher Wilson is someone who follows us on Surviving Head Trauma. And we appreciate her comments and her reactions to our posts. But she says that she has a story for sure to share during Brain Injury Awareness Month, but it's rather triggering for some. But it's one of those stories for survive and strive. So share, why don't you give our audience a little bit more about yourself, your background, and your story?
Okay. Well, it's hard to know where to start, but I guess I would start in 2001 with my son's traumatic brain injury. My son was injured in an assault and suffered a very serious, massive brain injury that left him in a coma for 6 months. So fast forward through that, I felt that I tried to turn it around and feel that I had a second opportunity to raise my 24-year-old troubled son, and I took the wheel and began the battle of advocacy and getting help for troubled youth with a serious, serious head injury, and became his comitee of person and estate and fought for him for the next 17 years.
Wow.
That's a long and drawn-out story in there in which he suffered in those first 17 years two psychotic breaks in which I was injured, physically injured. The first time he spent 18 months in the forensic psychiatric facility, found as what we call in Canada NCRMD, which is not criminally responsible by way of mental disorder.
Say mental challenges, was this a result of the brain trauma assault, or was this in addition to the assault?
No, as a result of the brain injury.
So prior to this incident, he seemed to be just progressing normally with normal adult teenage things and that type of thing. So things were relatively normal. Is that what you're saying before this incident?
Normal. Yes, he was troubled. He made some bad decisions, but he was extremely intelligent. Tested as having a 146 IQ at one point, but his brain injury destroyed all of that. He had to learn to read, write, walk, and talk again.
Okay.
What kind of assault was it for this type of severity?
The first assault that sent him to 18 months in forensic, he was in a bad group home, a poorly managed group home, and they had allowed alcohol on the premises, and he got his hands on a McDonald's Happy Cup full of vodka. They asked me to come and take him home because he was acting out, told me to detox him or he could not come back. So I brought him home for that weekend. He did not want to go back, and he suffered a psychotic break. I never saw it coming. I denied him a cigarette because we had to have compensatory strategies in place. He would smoke a cigarette and light the next one with the butt of the first one and smoke three packs a day, which we couldn't afford, and it's not good for him. So we had it timed down to 8 cigarettes a day because he didn't want to go back to the group home that morning. I denied him a cigarette, and in hindsight, perhaps I shouldn't have, and he just snapped. I never saw it coming. He struck me. I went to the floor in a pool of blood, kicked, kidney damage, and a minor head injury, nothing serious for me at that point, but I couldn't get up. He came back into his own state of well-being and walked over to the phone to call 911, to call police. And I couldn't get off the floor, and I said to him, "Maddie, don't call. Don't call police." And he picked up that phone, picked up a stuffed animal he had, hugged it, told the police, "I've been a very bad man. I've hurt my mom real bad. You need to come and get me." And they did. They took him away. I begged them not to let him go to a top bunk in the pretrial facility.
Right.
But they didn't listen. You know, I guess a mother protecting a big brain injured son, it's not always taken the way it should be. And Maddie was 6'3", 270 pounds, so he's a big young man. They let him go into the top bunk. He fell, you know, because he had double vision and depth perception issues and more. And he fell and broke his leg. So that was the start of his first incarceration. Not too long after I represented him at board hearing and got him an absolute discharge.
Because of the brain trauma?
Pardon?
Was the discharge because of the brain trauma?
No, the discharge was because he spent 18 months and we put forth a battle that he had support. He had a good family and he had me to come home to and me as an advocate. So we were saying that he had spent enough time.
So the network was in place to reduce maybe the recidivism and to support his well-being and growth. And health.
Yes.
And things in place. Yeah.
And yes, and forensics had a policy of encouraging family support and contact. So very slowly
right.
I was allowed to visit him. Very slowly I was allowed to take him for a day. Very slowly I was allowed to take him for a weekend. So we built up to that
right.
and then I fought the legal battle and we thought we won it. But our Brain Injury Association here in British Columbia came to have something that became known as the Wilson precedent after. They refused to reinstate funding for anyone that had an absolute discharge from forensics. Conditional discharge, you can get your funding back. But for an absolute no, and their reasoning for that was that with a conditional discharge, if something goes wrong, there's the option of taking him back into forensics. With an absolute
right.
discharge, something goes wrong, you try to get him into a psychiatric unit, and they'll always let him go in very short order, even if he's not, quote, unquote, under control. So we won the battle but lost the war, did get funding back, but he suffered another psychotic break not long after he returned home.
Well, sure, I'm sorry to hear that, but before you continue, I'd like to get a clarity on what you mean by funding. I'm not sure that I follow the losing funding for trauma,
okay.
Gaining
yes.
trauma. What is the funding?
Through the acquired brain injury program here, for extreme cases and situations, they do provide funding for group homes, for therapy, for assistance. It has to be hard fought to win that.
Now, is this the government
in
general? You're talking about the government providing?
It is provincially funded, yes.
Okay. And this is in Canada. Remember, remind our audience, you're calling from Canada, so this is a Canada.
Yes, I'm in British Columbia, Canada.
Okay.
Right, so it's a Canadian program, so the program may not be the same, and the financial assistance and support may be different wherever you are, whatever country where you're located. You'd have to check with your own authorities and systems to see what is in place. But this
yeah.
is in
Absolutely.
Canada, and you were able to qualify for some financial assistance due to what was going on with your son.
Yes, because of the severity of his injury as well. So,
is this something that happens automatically in Canada, or do you have to file and apply for this type of funding?
You have to file and apply, and you have to fight tooth and nail to get it.
Okay.
Right. But you obviously...
Most people do it with a lawyer.
Right.
Okay.
Oh, you represented yourself, you said. You're amazing.
I did. Well, I don't know. You know, just when you can't afford a lawyer, but you work for them, you find ways to get the job done. I worked in personal injury law for almost 40 years.
Oh, great. Okay. That was not by accident. That was divine intervention. So that's great.
Well prepared, yes. So then, I'm sorry, what happened after that? So after the second assault?
Another issue with the group home, with another group home, and was home to detox again. This time the culprit was marijuana. And for my son, with his level of brain injury, marijuana threw him into psychosis with amnesia.
Wow.
Oh, this is a new one, Cher. Slow down for a second. We advocate marijuana on this show, so you're giving us a different perspective. What happened when he tried the marijuana? Can you break it down to specifics?
Now, Carrie, you need to be specific also. You advocate marijuana, and there's a difference between marijuana and CBD and some of these other things. So it seems like son may have had some illegal drug, or maybe, you know, cannabis he was smoking or something. It wasn't a medicinal remedy that he was trying. That's what it sounds like. Now you can correct me if I'm wrong.
No, that's right. This was before marijuana was legalized in British Columbia, and it was street marijuana, but it was only marijuana. It affects different levels of brain injury in different ways.
Correct.
I was always a proponent. I was in favor of the calming effect that I presumed it would have, but Matthew, my son, suffered a paradoxical reaction with it.
Wow.
So with the next psychosis and attack on me, he didn't want to return, and he put a knife at my throat when I thought he was reaching around to hug me. And then he spent almost a year in regular jail, provincial prison, then for that.
Okay.
He was not found in CRMD the second time.
Well, Cher, let me ask you this now. You said this is the second assault on you. So at this point, are you still his advocate, or are you realizing that there's maybe more trauma involved than you can handle and realizes that he needs more assistance or aid?
I felt that I had no choice but to remain as his advocate and his comitee because he kept failing in these group homes. And as you know, all, like doctors and lawyers, all group homes are not created equal. And he was a handful.
Right.
He was large. He had behavioral problems. So there was a very small niche of people qualified to work with that. So every time he failed, he was either going to be on the street or come back home to me.
Right.
So I always allowed him to come back home to me.
Okay. Did you have a support system for your well-being and dealing with this, or were you totally alone in this situation?
Well, I had my doctor, I had a psychiatrist, I had friends.
So you did have a network
that supported you.
Right.
I did at that time, absolutely.
Okay.
And then
I worked in personal injury law.
You did what?
I find it really amazing that with all the support and the different programs, that these homes were not equipped to prevent and identify some of the triggers, because it seems like he's kind of on the edge and a few mishaps will send him into relapse, you know, backwards. So as he's making progress, you know, it seems like the homes let him down, that they really weren't able to.
They did, most definitely. And it's like, as you know, with some seniors facilities, some let the seniors sit there in a diaper all day with no attention, sitting over in a corner. It's the same way with brain injury. And he just happened to hit a number of homes that were less than well equipped.
Right.
The problem was because
and it also
he had
sounds
the
like he. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh no, that's all right. Because he had behavioral issues, because he had
mm-hmm.
a history of alcoholism pre-morbid, and because
mm-hmm.
of his size, the better group homes were reluctant to consider taking him.
Right. Got it.
Well, it seems, that
it.
Seems to sound like a paradox, some kind of twisted paradox, because the better homes would be able to better handle him, you would think. But you're saying they declined his acceptance.
Because he was a handful. And remember, 6'3", 270 pounds.
Okay.
Right.
And but how
that,
is he doing now?
What's sports and boxing, he was a force to be reckoned with, unfortunately.
What about today? How
Although,
is he now? What's his current status?
Pardon?
What's his current status?
But what
how
happened next with the story?
Well, after that 12 months in prison for the second assault, he came back home to me. We fought and fought to get him another group home. We landed in another moderate group home. I can't say it was the worst, but I can't say it was the best, and there were issues. But
right. Okay.
I kept working for something else, and finally, in 2014, he was accepted by a profoundly excellent home in Kamloops, B.C. So
okay.
he goes over to Kamloops. The director of the home is a highly qualified RN. She's German. She's got things down to a science in there. The home is well-maintained, well-operated, focusing on the positives and just saying, well, let's correct the negatives and go back to what you did right. But he had a good year there, and unfortunately she was involved in a head-on collision and suffered her own brain injury.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
Spinal column injury. So she had to retire. She had to leave the home. New management came in, and the home declined.
Right.
So,
oh, goodness.
And it went down exponentially. Every month there was something worse and something worse, and he was spending more and more time in my home, sleeping over in my place while I would go to work during the day and take him back to the home to be babysat. And then fast forward to 2017,
mm-hmm.
he started having seizure issues because he kept getting his hands on marijuana. Marijuana evoked serious seizure activity for him.
Okay.
And to take him, came home and found him unconscious from marijuana on two occasions, had to take him to the hospital by ambulance because he was unconscious with a seizure. Got him on a second seizure medication, but the things in the home are going downhill, and I decided, okay, I'm not happy in Kamloops. I'm not happy with my job. We decided that we are going to leave and go to Vancouver Island, start a new life, get him on a wait list for another excellent group home that we knew of, and we left. Then February 18th, 2018, which was BC
mm-hmm.
Family Day, my son
mm-hmm.
had got, unbeknownst to me, but my son had gotten his hands on marijuana again. I started to see concerning behaviors in the home. And then February 18th, I'm sitting at my computer early morning, typing a letter of advocacy for this group home that we were on a wait list for. We were to be going out for BC Family Day. We had our plans, and I never saw this coming. He was going to take a shower. I heard the closet door open in the hallway, which is where I kept the towels and the laundry basket. So I thought, oh, he's probably putting dirty clothes in there and getting a fresh towel. He quietly, carefully closed the closet door, and then I thought we'd had an earthquake.
Because he fell?
He struck me from behind with a claw hammer.
Oh, my goodness.
And And then what followed from there, he almost killed me.
This is the third time now, right?
Yes, it was the third time. And this time, the absolute worst. His first words to me were, and he spoke, every time he had these psychotic breaks, he spoke in a completely different voice. It was like something out of The Exorcist. He was changed. He was altered. The tempo of his speaking was different. His voice was deeper. It was bizarre. And the first thing he said to me, I screamed and said, "Maddie, it's Mom." I realized he was not in his own head. "Maddie, it's Mom. And he said, "I'm going to put you out of your misery. Today's the day you die."
Oh, my, no.
We had hardwood floors in that apartment, and I think, because my memory is sketchy through all of this, but I think he slipped in the blood, and that's how I had one chance to escape. I had covered my head. I had gone into a fetal position, my back up against the bed, and I was on the floor, and my both arms and hands over my head, protecting my head, because he was targeting my head with that hammer. I knew my ulna was broken, my right ulna was broken, because it was protruding through the skin.
Oh, my gosh, compound fracture.
Oh, well, yeah, and it turned out to be a lot more than that. Of course, I didn't know at the time. I knew it was bad. But I'm a former competitive bodybuilder, too, so I had good core strength, and that's how I was able to get up off the floor with both arms and hands destroyed. I didn't have enough time to get to the front door, which was about 10 feet away. I only had enough time to get around the corner by about 4 feet to the bathroom. I had no choice. I had a choice to either turn on the light or slide down on my back and lock the door. It took both hands to lock the door. I had to use my fingers. So I sat there in the dark while he tried to body slam the door. I was in and out of consciousness, and I had no idea how much time had passed. It was just a terrorizing situation. He called my friends. He called my contacts on my cell phone, and I could hear that. He watched cartoons in the living room as he ate a bowl of cereal and then came back to the door in that altered tone of voice and told me this was the day I was going to die.
That's horrible.
It was quite the ordeal. And I was in and out of consciousness.
Well, now, Cher, we've heard of a mother's love, but this sounds as if it's going so far. What was your resolution? How did you get out of this dangerous, life-threatening situation?
There was at one point, and again, I had no idea how much time had transpired because I was in the dark. I heard neighbors in the hallway talking, and I started to scream again. Now, earlier in the morning, all of that screaming and banging, not one person called police, which still boggles my mind to this day. But I still don't understand it. And, of course, I never had any opportunity to speak with them after the fact and ask why they didn't call. Mm-hmm. But when I started screaming again, and I kicked the wall, I screamed as loud as I could. I kicked the bathroom wall so hard that I put a hole in my bathroom wall. He finally body slammed the door, brought the door down, threw me into the bathtub, and told me if I shut up, he would stop hitting me. And then he turned and walked away. He just slowly lumbered away. I think I scissor kicked him and from the tub and perhaps struck him in the groin, which I meant to at that point. And it's the first time in my life I had struck my son. He lumbered back into the living room. I walked behind him quietly. I saw the hammer, the bloody hammer on the floor in the living room where he was going, and I turned left and went and used both hands who opened the deadbolt on my door and fell into the hallway, where I had three or four neighbors just standing there gossiping. And so I asked, I said, please call the police. The door to my neighbor across the hallway was open, so I just barged right into their apartment. Fire department attended first, and then ambulance attended. My son was apprehended shortly after he left, could hear my door slam. He was apprehended at the local Denny's restaurant, covered head to toe in my blood, and was taken to jail. And I was rushed to hospital for 9 orthopedic surgeries, about 20 lacerations to my head, MRI and the whole bit. I was in hospital for 5 weeks.
So now you're head trauma survivor. You're brain injury survivor now. That qualifies,
I am. I still, now it's 5 years later, I still have double vision. I still have depth perception problems. And I still have a lot of residual trouble from all of the orthopedic injuries. I had to have a lot of reconstructive surgery done. I had nerve damage. The judge pronounced an order that there would be no contact. I lived in fear for the first few years, afraid that he would be released early, afraid that he would find me, not knowing what he was going through in prison. It was just a bizarre scenario in every way. In 2016, I started to write to him, not knowing if the letters would be given to him. I told him that I forgave him. I sent him inspirational quotes. I made him a little picture book with inspirational quotes and some of our favorite pictures, and sent that to him, not knowing if he would receive it. And then July 6th, 2021, I get a doorbell ring, and it's the RCMP, which is our highest level of police up here, there to tell me it was about Maddie. And my first question was, has he hurt someone or did he escape? And he had died in prison very suddenly.
Oh.
He died of a seizure in prison.
Well, our condolences for your loss. But was he treated while incarcerated for his seizure disorder from the brain trauma?
No. This is the problem. When, had he been sent to forensics, he would have been treated. He would have received treatment. But because he went to a provincial prison, there is no treatment. He went in with on 6 different medications, and unfortunately, now I've had another battle here recently with the BC Coroner's Office. There's going to be a formal inquest. They think the prison may have erred in allowing Matthew to make the decision to stop his medication. So he stopped.
Well, now he was an adult, but you're I see. Well,
he was an adult, but he was mentally incompetent. But,
right.
So now the coroner is organizing a formal inquest because they think that this is something that needs to be addressed and changed in legislation through the penal system throughout Canada.
Now, is this where you talked earlier about the Wilson Act?
Well, no, the Wilson precedent came about with stopping any resumption of funding if they had an absolute discharge.
Okay.
So, although we got our funding, but they made an example from my son's case forward that no absolute discharge, because he had another psychotic break and another prison term. Absolute discharge, no, we are not going to fund you, but conditional discharge, we'll give you your funding back and we'll see how this goes. Yeah, it's been quite a rocky road, like a series of Murphy's Law events.
Well, it's interesting to hear how your laws in Canada are somewhat different than the ones in the United States. I mean, for him to be put in general population like that, it seems a bit reckless on the prison system. But I mean, I don't know if that part is much different than in the United States, because most of our population is affected by some type of mental impairment. So what then did you plan to do, rather? I mean, is there a lawsuit pending, or what's the next step for your action?
No, I won't sue. It's my professional assessment that the prison did the best they could. I believe that they were very good to him. He was the first year and a half in, apparently he was hell on wheels. Excuse the four-letter word on the radio. But he was constantly fighting, stealing other people's food. But he got through that. He had a psychologist. He had close contact with an Anglican pastor that was there, the prison chaplain. And he turned his life around as much as he possibly could have. I think they were very good to him. So I will not sue. There's nothing to be gained from that. But
so this was the last home that you found.
And I do hope to see legislation change, to see something changed in the penal system. So that would be my hope through this last battle, so to speak.
Well, you know,
what about
Cher,
you?
There's a lot. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I'm curious, after so many assaults with you, how are you now? Are you receiving treatment for brain trauma or mental well-being after such traumatic experience with your son?
Well, I went through a heck of a lot of counseling and fought as my own advocate for that, and victim services paid for a great portion of it. I was very fortunate. I was a complete and utter disaster, actually, until maybe January of this year. I've slowly improved, but I went into deep depression, developed agoraphobia, didn't want to leave my apartment, afraid of everything that breathed and moved. But I returned to the gym. I'm weight training again, and that has been my saving grace. You know, trying to find anything that made me happy, because nothing made me happy, but you know, the gym did. So I'm still at almost 70 years of age. I'm going in and training like a beast 4 days a week. So, but I'm
well,
okay.
You know, the things that you described. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm just going to say, I'm okay.
What you describe as far as agoraphobia and being afraid of things, those are typical traumatic brain injury things that we just see that normally. Those things are accentuated. So you have definitely kind of, a lot of people are going to identify, maybe not with your entire story, but with many parts of it. So the brain injury world is very wide and varied. And, you know, on the outside, without knowing your son or his history, he was probably, as you said, troubled. Many teenagers are troubled, and they don't go down that path that your beloved Maddie did. You know, there's something that turns them around, whether it's faith or family or counseling or medication. Some people, they make that turn, but some don't. And, I mean, your faith and just dedication to your family and your son, and it's just like above and beyond what many parents would be able to handle or, you know, just be capable of doing. I mean, I admire you for never once giving up on your son and never once doubting that you could do something, you know, the advocacy, the funding, the finding the home, moving, all these things that parents do for their children. It's just amazing. And,
you know, in fact, that's a good point, Michelle, because, you know, in the United States, we have certain organizations like Brain Injury Association of America, which we will hear from shortly.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any type of support system while you were going through all this? Is there an organization there for you and families like you when you were going through this?
At that time, there was not. But, you know, this started 20 years ago. This was in 2001 when she sustained his brain injury. Things have improved now, but 20, 23 years ago, it was a very different state of affairs. I was not liked by our provincial acquired brain injury program because I was a rigid advocate. I knew the law, and I quoted it at every opportunity to win the battle. And I was encouraged on more than one occasion that I was an aging parent and should step aside as his commettee. But I was his only advocate at the time, so I kept going with it. There wasn't any help for me at the time. There was no respite. I think at the time they just tried to shut me out so that I might walk away. I think they wanted to institutionalize him permanently. And that's what I was trying to fight. Who knows, in hindsight being 2020, I don't know if that would have helped. But in any event, I don't regret having been the advocate. There might be a few things I'd do differently now, but...
Well, you say hindsight is 2020, but, you know, we really like to appreciate your sharing your story, because not only does it reveal how we in the United States have more than we really, I guess, thought or take for granted, even with our organizations like Brain Injury Association of America, because other countries may not be so well equipped to handle such severe brain trauma. And it sounds as if your son certainly falls into the category of severe brain trauma. And the assault on you is what is alarming to me, because I haven't heard stories of such violence towards a loved one after brain trauma. So that's a new level of impairment, I think. So what's your advice to people who are entering this world of brain trauma?
Well, if you have a loved one with pre-existing emotional issues, pre-existing substance abuse issues, pre-existing propensities to violence, twice about letting them use anything other than CBD, because there is new research now that it's recognized that in severe brain injuries of certain types that cannabis, THC, does trigger seizures. So it's CBD is one thing. It has a different chemical effect. But I would say be careful with that. Get all of the help that you possibly can. Get yourself respite and counseling.
You know, but while you're thinking about that, Sarah, I really have a big question about the marijuana issue, because typically marijuana has been proven to stop seizures, in fact, eliminate many of them. So was marijuana, he purchased some type of illicit chemical in it, or was it treated with something, or was it
it wasn't
regular
treated.
Organic marijuana?
Yeah, the tox screens indicated it was only THC. There was nothing else in there with it. But his brain injury was severe. It was astronomically bad. He had just enough cognitive skill left to still be a convincing con artist in some ways, charming and almost narcissistic. But, it caused seizure with him on more than one occasion. So, and we have tracked it back to the THC.
Well, that really spins a different approach to the medical marijuana. So that's, I guess it depends on the person and the person's body chemistry. Michelle, you're a pharmacist. How do you explain that?
Well, I mean, the brain is like a mystery. And every brain is different. Every brain injury is different. So when you have a brain injury and then you have a mind-altering chemical that you're adding into the mix, you're
not.
But
is the flower
really
a chemical?
A flower, or, you know, there are chemicals. Flowers have chemicals. When you're adding something, then you can maybe predict what may happen. But just said, her son had a very different reaction to something that may have made other people sleepy or calm. His brain was behaving in a different way. And there's only one, not only one way, but one way to find out what's going to happen is you test it. So he took the test, he took the marijuana, and maybe a more, the person that did not have the brain injury might have been able to say, oh my goodness, you know, this is bad, I can't do it, or make a different judgment and not do it anymore. But where the brain injury was, what was going on in his brain, compulsion, you know, gratification, all these things are all tied
violence.
Up in his little brain.
Violence.
And
don't forget,
he had
a violence.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Right. You know, Ms. Cher said, he physically changed. The voice was different. The demeanor was different. He was troubled. There's a difference between troubled and violent. So what point did these changes become, you know, severe in the brain? We don't know. I don't know. And we won't find out looking backwards, but as she's doing, she's looking forward to healing herself, working on herself, looking for guidance to the future. And that's where the happiness is and the resolve. We don't know. Looking back won't really change anything. It won't at all. And I don't think she's looking backwards, but I think I could be wrong, but I think it sounds as though this Wilson is getting her life, putting back together and doing things that enrich her and therefore building connections in her own brain that are right. I don't know how I got to that point, but the answer to your question is every brain is different and how it's going to react to different things is different, whether they're natural or chemical, man-made, or organic or not. You can't really tell till you take it. And then you find out. And then it may be too late.
So you trial and error, basically, like life, the rest of us, until we find something that works, like you said, unless we find out too late. We unfortunately lost Cher Wilson from Canada tonight because her phone died.
Oh,
she's
no.
texting me right now. Yeah, she's sincerely apologizing for losing us on her phone. But she did call us all the way from Canada. So we appreciate you tonight, Cher, sharing your story with us. Hey, that sounded funny, sharing your story. Thank you, Cher, for sharing your story and your son's horrible experience with this journey of life. But it goes to show that not every brain injury ends on a happy note because, I mean, dying in prison of a seizure, that's another level of extreme. And we'll talk about this and more when we come back from this month, marked Brain Injury Awareness Month for the Brain Injury Association of America. We'll be right back in 18 seconds.
March is Brain Injury Awareness Month. Learn more about brain injury by calling the Brain Injury Association at 1-800-444-6443, 1-800-444-6443, on the web at biausa.org.
biausa.org. So you know, thinking for the BIAUSA.org, Brain Injury Association of America, we, I guess, now are more appreciative of organizations like this, because from what I hear from Cher, there wasn't a type of organization for that kind of support, even after she had been assaulted 3 times by a brain trauma survivor.
Right. And to me, that's just a dedication. I mean, that's a mom. You know, parents don't generally give up on their children. I do recognize that's extraordinary.
A claw hammer?
I didn't want to. Sorry?
A claw hammer? Yeah, that's kind of extreme.
I'm saying, this story is very extreme and has twists and pulls, and gosh, it would make a great movie. But it's true. And it's so sad and heart-wrenching to just hear her voice and her story, how she was dedicated to that son, and the turn of circumstances led him down this path of incarceration and seizures, mental illness, and his, you know, eventual demise, which, he, you know, left a lot of people in the wake, kind of wrapped up a lot of energy in trying to get him well, and it sounds as though he wasn't interested in getting well.
Well,
you know,
when you talk about a brain trauma survivor, it sounds, when you say he wasn't interested in getting well, it doesn't, I mean, it almost sounds as if that can be a conscious choice made by a clear-headed thinking person. But when you've been injured neurologically like that, do you really make choices that are wise at all anyway? I mean, at some point, it seems like there should be an external force or an external person, an advocate, if you will, making choices for you at his level of extreme.
Well, right. Yeah. You know, I did kind of miss that point, but you're exactly right. And his mom did say, Miss Wilson did definitely say that he had been deemed incompetent and was on medication, but then took the initiative to take himself off the medication and had the wherewithal to add marijuana into the mix, full on knowing that it was not, that it was how it affected his brain. So there were steps that he was making, and they were not good. And as she said, she tried to get the help from him. But he may not even have been aware. You know, the awareness could be lacking, you know, with what was going on with him at the time. So he may not be expected to fully understand what was going on.
Well, what confuses me the most is what I advocate from the bottom of my heart, because it's worked so well for me, is the marijuana use. In his case, it had just the antithesis, or the opposite effect on what it generally does for seizure patients, and it made him a virtual despondent person to other people.
Violence. But like I said, no, that's not uncommon. You know, it is not uncommon for anxiety, other mental illnesses to be exacerbated, worsened, exaggerated, psychoses and seeing things and hearing things. That many, like I said, the brain is very complex, and we're not without knowing what's going to be lit up and excited and what's going to be diminished. When you take a brain-altering mental status type of drug that's going to, you know, a chemical you're putting in your body is being subjected to this chemical that we know has psychotropic effects. It's going to do something to your brain, whatever that something is. Let's find out.
Well, you know, what's funny is that it's, it gives us a different perspective, though, because I've always been purely 100%, oh, yeah, it'll help for any problem, whatever, it'll help, help, help. Share tonight changed my perspective and my advocacy for the plant, because we now see that on some people, like you just said, it's the chemical reaction to that person, and everybody's different. So what works for Terry Smith may not work for Michelle Lindorf. So we have to, I guess, approach it like any other medication, a tiny bit at a time to see how it affects us.
Right. Or use alternate. Just because something says it's from a plant, there's a big thing on TikTok right now about this stress-relieving, plant-based, all-natural plant thing, ashwagandha, you know, and it's been around for ages. But now it's blowing up, and everybody's taking it. All the kids are taking it, because, not all the kids, but it's very popular with young people, I'll say, in my old person voice, because it's supposed to calm and boost mental acuteness and all kinds of different claims on this package, you know, stress relief. And the people are taking advantage of this over-the-counter, natural, plant-based thing that is going to help their brains, and you don't know exactly if it's going to be calming for you, if it's going to lower cortisol levels, if it's going to do, you take it and see. But because CBD oil or cannabis or whatever works for one person, it's a whole holistic type of way to look at the thing. And I just think I'm more skeptical of everything.
So this is a commercial right now on television here in the United States. I forget the name of the product, but it's a pill that they promise to make your mental acuity more vibrant and clarity more crystal, and just make your whole mental well-being uplifted. It's not a medicine. It's not a pharmaceutical drug, but you can order it from the TV and the commercials. And they talk so heavily about it being a natural product to uplift your brain capacity, your thought ease. So you're saying that kind of thing you would resist because of the implications of potential harm?
The potential for harm is there. I mean, breathing air and drinking the water. Tell people in Flint, Michigan that the water's safe, okay? I mean, you know, something you think is not harmful could be very harmful. There was a time when cigarettes were safe, you know? So a little skepticism about, just do your research, maybe try it and see. I'm not saying that, oh, nothing is good, don't take anything. I'm a pharmacist. My job is medicine. So I'm very closely intertwined with chemicals and how the body works and what to take and what not to take and does it work and don't take those two together. But that's very simplistic. The body is very complex when we're talking about how many people are on the earth, genetics, history, brain injury thrown in the mix. All of a sudden, you've got a very unique scenario which could be altered for the good or for the bad. We don't know by whatever chemical.
Yes. Well, so we finished our first hour. Yes. So our first hour is down. So one more message. We have a few messages tonight from Brain Injury Association. Let's give them another 21 seconds from Brain Injury Association of America.
If you've experienced a brain injury, you're not alone. For help, call the Brain Injury Association today at 1-800-444-6443, 1-800-444-6443, on the web at BIAUSA.org.
Yes, Brain Injury Association, now we're learning, if you're in the United States, is an excellent organization wherever you're located. They probably have a chapter near you, so get in touch with them. So, Michelle, I see that we have expanded our views. At least I have expanded mine. I think you've always been pretty stable with the marijuana approach. But I was more of an advocate, and now I'm somewhat skeptical. I'm hesitant to recommend it to everyone because after Cher's story, we don't know. It might, like you said, have a negative impact. So you should proceed with caution.
I definitely think you... Yeah, that you have had, it's very accepting of certain things, and I'm just more skeptical.
Well, you know, it's funny because I developed a seizure disorder after my brain trauma and was taking prescription seizure medications for decades. And when I started medical marijuana, my seizures slowed down, almost vanished. I mean, I had to modify my seizure my prescription medication, the pharmaceutical medication, but it was, I went from, like, I cut it by 3/4 of the amount of pills I had to take with the onset of the marijuana. Uh-huh. So in my case, it worked tremendously well. So we don't want to totally dismiss it, but now I'm not going to just blindly advocate it for everyone. So it's a hit or miss trial and error reality. But Cher sent us a message after she was disconnected, and she said that she thanks us for bringing the show and that she hopes that her perspective gives food for thought to our listeners. And she didn't want to be just a morbid and sad tale. She hopes that there are positives that can be gleaned out of the entire scenario, over 18 years of this TBI and 5 years of her own. She also wrote a part of the story in a 3-part book series, A Tale of Two Psyches, Chaos for the Fly, Hell House, Before the Mask Slips. So she's working on her fourth book now, and we hope that she does extremely well and helps a lot of people with her book releases and the books she has written. So Cher Wilson, thank you very much for appearing on our episode tonight. But Michelle, I think that since it's Brain Injury Awareness Month, we've heard now about brain trauma in what we consider a traditional TBI, traumatic brain injury, but there are acquired injuries that you don't get from external forces that hit you in the head or automobile accident or slip and fall, but things that you're born with or that develop naturally. In our case tonight, Alzheimer's is one of focus, because for the first time in my life, I have a dear family member who is at the beginning stages of Alzheimer's, and even at this early stage, I am just drawn to tears when I talk with her and see the decline of this once highly functional, extremely intelligent, articulate woman be reduced to that of a child, almost not knowing people anymore, not knowing who or what is real, going back and forth in and out of reality. It's heart-drenching, and I've done some research for our audience tonight so that we can talk about more about Alzheimer's during Brain Injury Awareness Month, because every brain trauma is not just from an accident. So
right.
I'd like to share with our audience some of the things we need to look for when we think it's just maybe the person is an older person. It's just senility or whatever the new word for that is. But now with dementia and Alzheimer's, it could be significantly worse. But just like many diseases, the changes in the brain that are related to Alzheimer's begin before symptoms are noticeable. So this time period is often called the preclinical Alzheimer's disease. So it likely begins 10 or 15 years before people have symptoms, says Dr. Walk, the writer of this article who talks about it. He says currently there's no treatment for this preclinical stage, but they're hoping that in the future they can have medications that can help, that can halt the process so that people will have symptoms, fewer symptoms rather, and prevent the disease. But because of the risk, if Alzheimer's increases with age, and my relative is 94 years old right now, so it's important to keep up with regular primary care visits to allow for screening, because you can detect the earliest signs. And if you noticed your loved ones with cognitive abilities beginning to slip, that may mean they're entering the second stage of Alzheimer's, and that's basic forgetfulness.
Okay.
So we go on and on, but I want to pause to just acknowledge the fact that Brain Injury Awareness Month this year, for the first time, and we've talked about this every year in March, we do Brain Injury Awareness Month, but this is the first year for me that I am introduced to a new level of trauma that breaks my heart. To see someone you love decline so rapidly is mind altering. Do you know anyone with Alzheimer's, Michelle? Have you encountered this in personal effect?
No, not. I mean, my granddad had. He was 101 though, so he almost made it to 102. He had a little bit of everything: dementia, Alzheimer's. At that point, I'm not really sure what was going on. He couldn't really see things. I just remember that they would, when we went to visit, we would have a focal point. We would take a physical photo album. He remembered the old days. So we'd just bring out an old photo album that he had, and we would talk about the pictures there in the photo album, because what was going on right now, he wasn't really able to add any more memories to his, you know, he saw us, sometimes he'd recognize. So I don't know really dementia versus Alzheimer's. I don't know. And he was so old that, you know, he wasn't really doing a whole lot anyway. So I don't know what he had. But I haven't had, the answer is no, I haven't really had any interaction with an Alzheimer's patient.
Well, I tell you, it sort of puts me in an idea that they saw us when you and I had our brain trauma, our family members around us and friends around us. We could not, and I mean, it's impossible to see from someone else's perspective of what they think of us. But at least I didn't, and I'm sure you didn't have an idea of what they were thinking or feeling. But we were just surviving our injury, and that was it. But now from this side, it gives like a totally different perspective of what they may have been going through when we were at our worst, because it's a totally different experience to see the person go through what they don't even realize they're going through. Because often she'll talk about people who are dead as if they were alive, and to her they are alive and real, and to see that is what's heartbreaking. So,
well, it's heartbreaking for you. She's going forward. You need to go forward. Not you need to. Maybe consider being in the moment with her and experiencing whatever she's experiencing right then. If you could bring a book, a memory book, something she recognizes or knows, a focal point to discuss, because if you're trying to talk about what's happening or what's current, there may be a time, and it may not be that far in the future, where she doesn't recognize you. Oh, who are you? You know.
Oh, I can imagine that. Oh, my goodness.
you know, that could be, you know, that could be coming. And it may come suddenly, and she may forget you this time and remember you the next. So, like I was saying, I don't know how the brain works, but every brain is different. And will it help to have pictures and talk about things or take pictures while you're there? Maybe. But, you know, I definitely go and print the picture out, take a picture of her with you, a selfie, and give it to her so she can have it and refresh her memory to who you are, that you're safe, you know, while she still remembers you. Just prepare. You don't know what she's going to lose. But every day that she goes to sleep, she wakes up probably with less.
That's what the, you know, prognosis is, that it's a progressively worsening disease. But to getting back to recognizing the symptoms before they become just blatantly obvious, stage two is basically forgetfulness, and everybody can be a little forgetful from time to time, and it's likely to happen more as we age. But the very early stages of Alzheimer's can look like normal age forgetfulness, but your loved ones might have memory lapses, including forgetting people's names or where they left their keys, but they can still drive, work, and be social. However, these memory lapses become more frequent. So you need to look for the frequency of these lapses, because you will probably notice this is before your loved one does. You don't know what you don't know. So they'll repeat themselves over and over again, and you'll be the one who recognizes it. And you might be able to get treatment sooner.
We all do that, though. I mean, there's a point where, I forgot. Where are my keys? Oh, you know, I use my keys. I don't want to say on the regular, but if I come in and I don't put my keys where I normally put them, then they're lost. They're not in my purse or hanging on the hook, they're lost.
But is that a frequent thing? How often? Is that a normal daily thing that you do constantly?
If I'm not mindful about the keys or anything, I will have something in my hand and put it down to grab something else. So it seems very childish, maybe, or immature. I don't know what the word is to describe that behavior, just distracted. But if I'm focused on something, not what I'm doing, then, you know, and that spills over into my job too. I'm not a real great multitasker. I can multitask to a point, but there's a number of things that I can't, there's a point where you have to stop. You know, you can't, most people can't read two books at the same time or listen to a radio show and the TV.
Maybe we need to have you screened, Michelle, because that's one of the things here. It's saying frequency. The level of frequency is what determines an early stage of something to be investigated. And if you're doing this frequently,
maybe I should.
Yeah, there is screening that you can do. And so it may be able to, if you get the sooner your treatment, you may be able to slow the progression of the disease sooner. But stage three says there's noticeable memory difficulties. For instance, this stage may bring noticeable changes, and it will become harder to blame age. Because it's common to be diagnosed with this stage, because it's when a person's daily routine becomes disrupted. Common difficulties in this stage go beyond forgetting names and misplacing objects like your keys. Your loved one may have trouble remembering recently read materials such as books or magazines, or remember plans organizing increasingly difficult, or have more difficulty retrieving names or words, experiencing challenges in social settings or at work. So these things that you will notice before your loved one. So when you make these observations, it's time to maybe move on to clinical assistance. But there are other stages. The fourth stage is more than memory loss. Now, in this stage, damage to the brain involves other aspects of cognition outside of memory, including some difficulty with language, organization, and calculations. These problems can make it more challenging for our loved ones to perform daily tasks even. And in this stage, which can last for many years, our loved ones will experience major difficulty with memory, major difficulty. And this may still remember, I mean, they may remember significant details about their life from maybe from childhood as to who they were married to or what state they live in. But the memory of day-to-day smaller activities will vanish. They don't have the time. So they're confused about the day of the week, where it is. They have an increased risk of wandering off or getting lost. And their sleep pattern changes too, such as restlessness at night or sleeping during the day, and difficulty in choosing appropriate clothing for weather on the occasion. So that's when you realize that you're now approaching a more advanced stage and it's time for help.
Well, you know, you said something about losing cognition or ability for calculations and math. And I remember when I did have my brain injury, there's like certain calculations that in pharmacy you just know how many grams are in 100 mils and how many percent that is. So there's like a couple of little formulas that just kind of are always there. And I remember I lost my phone numbers, you know, like number sense went away at first with my brain injury. That was hard for me.
Now you said at first.
Stuff,
does that mean it returned?
Yeah, I don't think I'm as strong as I was in the math arena, but I'm not being tested, so I'm not really, it's not a focus anymore, but, you know, figuring out, you know, how much compounded interest and whatever. There, you know, you can kind of figure out approximately how much you're going to have in 10 years if it's compounded, and how much medicine is going to be in somebody's system after a while. If, you know, there were different things that just kind of came naturally, and I don't really have that 100% back, and it's been 10 years.
Was there ever a point in your recovery process that you were afraid that you might not recover enough to continue being a pharmacist?
I never crossed my mind. Just being honest, it crossed my mind early on because I wasn't working. But then as I got better, I never thought that I would not go back to work. So I don't know. And then I think I was naive. I'm sure I was naive because I never had a brain injury before. But once I found myself, once I went back to work, that's when it became very obvious that something wasn't going right.
Impairment, deficits.
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't remember phone numbers or who I talked to and different stuff. So that did go away, but like I said, it was training and working and different things. But I was not going to ever go back to work again.
Well, that's good for positive thinking and direction. But at the same token, it sounds as if there's a clear and distinctive difference between brain trauma, TBI, and Alzheimer's, because you made an improvement, you saw an improvement, whereas Alzheimer's, it goes just the opposite direction. It just goes to decline.
But there's not really a way to reverse that or slow it, or, you know, it's very invasive. It's nonstop. So once it starts, it's aggressive.
You're right. And in fact, stage 5 is decreased independence. It's like until now, your loved ones may have been able to live on their own with no significant challenges, but you may have dropped in on to check on them every so often, but for the most part, they were able to function without regular assistance. But in this stage, stage five, your loved ones will more than likely have trouble remembering people who are important to them, such as close family and friends. Like you said earlier, at some point, Lynn may just not even know who I am, but they may struggle with learning new things, and basic tasks like getting dressed might be too much for them. So, and there are also emotional changes, hallucinations, seeing things that aren't there, delusions, false beliefs that you believe to be true, and paranoia, the feeling that others are against you. So, I mean, that's at stage five, which is decreased independence. So it's a debilitating disease that progressively worsens, and there's no pharmaceutical drug or natural herb that can help this one except time to wait for the person to pass on and remove the misery, because that's what one of the things that broke my heart the most when I heard Helen. She was talking about the suffering. She said, "Why doesn't the Lord take me away from? Why does he make me suffer and not just take me away from all this?"
Well, she's not suffering, really. She's in a memory home.
According to her, it's her definition of her own reality. So you it's hard to tell someone that they're not suffering. I mean, it's their impression of their own feeling. So in her eyes, what she's going through is a suffering effect.
Right. She's got this body that works and the brain that doesn't. I don't know what's worse, having, you know, if you had to choose, would you have a healthy body or a healthy brain? One of them's got to go. It's very difficult. You can't really function without both of them working on some level, you know?
Which brings home to a lot of the episodes you and I have talked about over the last years about mental exercise, the manipulatives that we do to keep our brain exercised, becomes exceedingly more important as we age, because as we age, the onset of Alzheimer's, dementia, and all the other problems with memory just as natural part of aging set in. So it's imperative that we do those physical exercises, those mental brain exercises, the fresh air, eating healthy, all the things that we may take for granted help us fight away this horrible, horrible mind life-changing disease. So stay on top of the exercise.
We don't know. You know, yeah, diet, exercise, taking your vitamins, drinking water. I don't know what the preventative measures really are and who's predetermined to get it. You know, is it your destiny because of heredity, or is it, you know, where you lived? Is it, you know, it's everywhere. So we're living longer. I don't know if there's some exposure to some physical thing that could happen that patients all have in common. I don't know. But,
that's the frightening part of it. We don't know it. That's the unknown is what makes it so devastating, because it's like brain trauma. One of our one-liners is anyone, anywhere, anytime. That's what, for brain injury, it could happen. But the more we research Alzheimer's, as we age, again, anyone, anywhere. So
it's true, but you know, that's why I think it's very important to live life to the fullest, do what you can when you can, and take advantage of all learning opportunities and chances to grow. Look at obstacles as growth opportunities. It's very difficult sometimes to do that, but if you can, then do.
Michelle, that is beautifully said. You're right. You're absolutely right. It's about appreciating every breath, every inhale, every exhale, because time is not guaranteed. I mean, we're all going to reach that point where we transition from life to death. Everyone is going to die of something. The question is, how do we want to live?
Oh, that's right. How do you want to live? We're all going to go back to bones, ashes to ashes. I went to dinner yesterday, and like a little talk seminar type thing for Lent. And the man that we spoke of was named, he was Dutch, Henry Nouwer or Newer, N-U-O-W-E or something like that. Very unusual spelling. He was a priest. And he said something, we had a video of him. He did, he passed away at 64 in 1996. But we had a little video we watched. And he said, you know, your life is not determined by what you have and who you are, what people say about you. Those things could, you know, you can go up and down with that. Someone says they like your dress, you feel good. Someone says, you've gained 10 pounds, suddenly you feel bad. You're balding, you feel bad. You know, all kinds of things external can make us, we can take on board and feel a particular way. And if you're going to live your life going up and down with all these external influences, it's not a good way to live. That doesn't define you. And he kind of gave more religious definitions of who we are. And
it's about appreciating
so good,
life.
Though.
Is this about life
about
appreciation?
About appreciating life, yes.
Gratitude.
And all gratitude and just knowing that you're not an accident and that things happen to get you, obstacles are there for you to grow. There are opportunities to grow. I don't know exactly what he said.
Michelle, but it was, you know, when I hear that, I think about what Cher Wilson told us when her son, after his trauma, became such a violent person and attacking his mother with a claw hammer. I think what's that supposed to teach us? What are we learning from that? I mean, she, as a mother, loved her son after being attacked with a claw hammer. So what do we get from this? I mean, some grander message? Lesson?
Of course. There's a message in it, yes. And I don't know what she was to learn from that. I don't know. I mean, she can glean something. She's got a story, and she's lived through it multiple times. So, and she tried her best to get help for her son. And you know, it was really remarkable, her courage and perseverance and the ability to get him help repeatedly over and over and never give up. So I don't know what the message, you know, why was he attacked? I don't know. What was he supposed to learn from that? I don't know. But there's just questions that each obstacle and every difficult situation we're in presents a opportunity for us to make some choices. And every choice that we make opens doors and closes doors. So we will be facing the same, it's like Groundhog Day, that's one of my favorite movies. The same obstacles come up till you figure it out.
That's how it works. It seems. Yeah, what we don't learn, we repeat.
Yeah.
In fact, speaking of Cher, while we're talking about Cher, she sent a note after her phone disconnected saying that her books are written under a nom de plume or pseudonym as Sarah Martin. So you'll find her books under the author's name, Sarah Martin. And
well, you know, I did find her story, her son's obituary. Oh, it's beautiful. Matthew Wilson. And I think there are pictures of her family and the son there. And, you know, that smile, he's got such a just beautiful, happy pictures, you know, and I think she's there.
Oh, you're and, fast. Like, how did you find that? Where did you find it?
I sent it to you while she was talking. I looked.
Oh,
okay.
I missed that one.
Googled it.
Oh, here it is. I see it. Okay.
Yeah, Google is amazing. So they have like 50, 45 pictures up. But
okay.
It's very encouraging, very, it's a sad ending, you know, but for him, but.
And for her too, I'm sure, to lose her son.
Yeah, but it's encouraging that she is alive and is going forward with the rest of her life. And even though she's recalling the story of the past, it doesn't feel as though she's in the past. You know, she's not trying to go through some long drawn out lawsuit. She's not blaming anyone. She's remembering the son that she lost and seems grateful for the life that she has and the time that she's had him. You know, and,
that's
you know, if there's any sadness he had, I think it's for, you know, maybe not seeing him have his own family or get well enough to, you know, do those type of things. Because that's what, you know, parents want for their kids, them to live independently without them. And so she didn't, that's what makes me sad, that she didn't have that future with him. Not
and
the past. The past can't.
Well, it also sounds like she didn't have a support system while she was going through it, which is sad as well. I mean, because
well,
often we realize that she did.
She had. Yeah, she had friends, family, and she had professional help, you know, support.
Oh, I'm thinking about
so
the
it may not
have, Brain Injury Association kind of support, but I, well, you're right. I guess she did have the family, which is essential.
Yeah,
and that's
she may
important
not have
part.
Had, yeah, I mean, it's never too late. She could always find, you know, it's worldwide, isn't that?
Well, Brain Injury Association of America. Speaking of which, we have time for a fourth PSA from them. So we'll be back in 37 seconds.
Okay.
A brain injury can change the way you think, the way you act, the way you move, and the way you feel. If you or someone close to you has experienced a brain injury, you are not alone. More than 2.5 million children and adults sustain brain injuries in the United States each year. For help, call the Brain Injury Association of America at 1-800-444-6443, on the web at www.biausa.org. Get the help you need today.
Brain Injury Association of America. They are a support system for people, yeah, but the Association of United States of America. So we take for granted, I think, like I said earlier, the support systems that we have installed in our system. But it also sounds as if the Canadian system for the income, the money is something that we don't have here. I haven't found a source for that type of assistance for patients who don't have insurance or any other type of financial support. Even though Cher said that it was difficult to get, it was at least available if you went through the efforts to apply for it, which is...
Well, we do have disability and Social Security and different support systems for disabled, American persons with disability. They're different, different companies that I know of that do have support, and I think their resources are free. They may not give money per se, or there may be a branch that does provide financial assistance, but my understanding is the companies like APD, I think it's American Persons with Disabilities, and there are a couple other ones, and it doesn't, not specific for, say, brain injury, but disability, so Down syndrome and autism or other just different disabilities which may prevent a person from getting a job or getting hired or whatever that, but we do have some, but it's not, a lot of places they're not well organized or easy to navigate. So it just takes time and persistence. And that's why my kudos to this Cher, because she just really advocated for her son and found as many channels and people to support him and her own efforts. You know, she did have quite a vast, she had a big task to do, I tell you.
Well, you know, I give her a standing ovation, because I tell you, you know, love is love, even a mother's love. I tell you, I wonder if it's enough to have that kind of passion after someone's attacked you with a claw hammer. That's a mother's love beyond anything I can comprehend.
Well, there were three separate attacks, and it seems from the story that she tells, we'll have to wait for the movie and the book to come out, but there was always an event and a drug or some outside influence
trigger of some kind.
Yeah, there was a trigger that pushed Maddie over. So he wasn't quite in the right place, and then he got booze, you know, a cup of vodka, and he got kicked out, and the circumstances changed. And as you and I both know, we've got kids, and kids, most people do well with a routine. Yeah, I'm going on vacation. I'm not going to do this and do that. And okay, well, this week we're doing something different. That's fine. But generally, most people, they wake up a certain hour, they have their coffee or their breakfast, they do lunch, they do some sort of a job or employment or school, and it finishes at a particular time, and they come home and they have another meal and have a talk with the family and maybe go to a gym or something or some other activity, and then they go to sleep and do it again. So there's this kind of routine of, you know, what's going to happen, and it's comforting. And I think what stands out for me is that Maddie never had that comfort, because he was chained from place to place and each one wasn't quite right and his needs weren't met mentally, socially, emotionally, whatever. Something was not being met, and, you know, he was intimidating. He's a big guy. So for a big guy not to be in control, and, you know, not boxing or wrestling or doing some real physical outdoorsy sport, that energy's got to go somewhere. So I don't know. I could be wrong.
Well, you know, I don't know if there's a right or wrong answer, because I think everyone is going to handle the same situation differently. I mean, three people in the same scene will describe it differently. So there's not a right or wrong as much as there is just of the variable of the person, the individual, and how he or she reacts and handles their reality. But
right.
we can still intervene, hopefully, if we recognize symptoms. Like the stage six, for example, if we're recognizing symptoms, these are severe symptoms. Living on your own requires you to be able to respond to your environment, like knowing what to do if a fire alarm goes off or the phone rings.
Yeah.
But during stage six,
this
becomes
Alzheimer's?
Difficult. Yeah, this is for Alzheimer's.
You're back with Alzheimer's. Okay.
Yeah, because with Alzheimer's, your loved ones can become significantly worse with this as time progresses, which we understand. But the impact, it impacts his or her ability to manage their own care, and they'll become more dependent on others. It's becoming more severe. It's communicating may also become more difficult during this stage.
How many stages do you have?
Well, there are seven primary stages to recognize before you absolutely know that you're in trouble. So we're in the sixth stage now. And this is when your loved one may still use words and phrases, but communicating about special thoughts as where they're experiencing pain can be challenging. They have significant personality changes due to and it's including increased anxiety, hallucinations, delusions, and paranoia.
Right.
And their independence continues to decrease. So your loved ones may become more frustrated with you. There are both medicines and behavioral strategies that may help in these instances, which you can discuss with your care team. But while the behavioral changes are not universal and some patients may be content throughout the course of that disease, when they do occur, you have to remember that they are unaware of what they're doing. So you can't take it personally, and that's however a sign that you do need help, that you're no longer in a position to take this on by yourself, and that can be difficult because someone you love, like Cher, her son, she's taken a hammer from him, and my gosh, she's still standing by his side with the mother's love, looking out for his best interest and advocating for his help.
Right.
So Michelle, I think that we just really reiterate, we can't reiterate it enough to just appreciate the gift of mindset and each inhale and exhale.
Okay. Well, I'm appreciating. I'm alive.
And you're about
alive.
To take off tomorrow, so you enjoy your trip. How long are you going to be gone? On your next trip.
Oh, a while. I've got plenty to do tomorrow, so I won't be the day's not all travel. But usually I don't really mention when I'm going and when I'm coming back. So I like
I've got
somebody in my house, so just because my car's not here, you know. We'll have a different car. I've told the neighbors, okay, this car is allowed to be here. So, you know, but I'll be gone part of next week.
Oh, good.
Just a short break. It's a family reunion, really. So my people from Chicago and Texas, we're all meeting in Denver. So I'll bring you back some snow.
Well, you take yourself some warm clothes so you don't get cold while you're in that snow. But you can also keep an eye on how we've learned so much more about Alzheimer's. Watch out for your older family members because you don't see it coming. Because, I mean, people who are just so intelligent your whole life and articulate your whole life and just seem to be on top of the ball your whole life, one day they're not. Everything is working fine until it doesn't anymore, and you go to a family.
I said my lecture that I went to Wednesday. That's one of the things that Henry spoke of in one of his lectures. That we take, once we have health and money and things, and compliments and friends and all these things, once they are gone, we're still who we are. So we can't, it's not a good idea to balance or value yourself by your prestige or your money or what someone externally says. It's inside of you. And you have to fight for that every day.
You brought up an excellent point I wanted to say, but I didn't think of it until you just said what you said. And that's watching my family member go through this, watching her decline, it hit me then that nothing of value, of physical value, monetary value, or any worldly possession, it means nothing. None of that means anything when you don't have your mind and you're
right.
Not in control of, and you have to be locked behind a gate so that you don't run out in the middle of the night or run naked through the streets.
Yeah.
Money means nothing. Your mansions mean nothing. Wealth means nothing. It's about the quality of life. It makes you appreciate, grasp the art of life, being alive.
Right. Health and vitality. But yeah, health is fleeting. Money will go. Possessions will be squandered, lost, stolen,
it means nothing if you don't have yourself. Yeah. With 13 minutes left, let's go over the last stage, seven.
We can do seven.
Number seven, the last one. This is the lack of physical control. Alzheimer's destroys brain cells, so eventually this can cause severe mental and physical impairment. So our loved ones may begin to shut down as their mind struggles to communicate and delegate tasks effectively. And at this point, our loved ones may need significant assistance, and they may need round-the-clock care for help with walking, sitting, and eventually swallowing. And because of their reduced mobility, their body can also become vulnerable to infections such as pneumonia. And to help avoid infections, we keep their teeth and mouth clean, treat cuts and scrapes with the antibiotic ointments right away, and make sure they get their flu shots each year to keep the basic things away from them, because that's the final stage when there's not much time left. And that's one of the questions we have here. How long does Alzheimer's last before death? And the average answer here is the person with the disease can live between 3 and 11 years after diagnosis. Some people live 20 years, but 3 to 11 years after diagnosis is the general consensus. So
standard. Okay.
Yeah, so we have so much to be grateful for. What's that?
Yep. I said I'm going to try my best not to catch anything. Alzheimer's, dementia, amnesia, nothing. I don't want none of it. I just want to fade away and turn to dust. The end.
Well, you know, that's the ideal way to go. And fortunately, a lot of people do go that way and pass away in their sleep. But unfortunately, there are those who we love who find themselves not knowing who they are anymore.
Right.
And we need to give them the kind of support they gave us when we were children. And it's a sad cycle. But life happens, and we deal with it the best we can. So hopefully, Michelle, you and I help our listening audience to some degree with our guests and our research and studies that we discuss on Surviving Head Trauma on the Brain Injury Radio Network. And we have 10 more minutes for this month's episode. So we, again, would like to thank Craig Cecilia, our network owner, who pays all the bills around here and keeps us on air so that we can have a voice in our silent epidemic. And Kim Justice, our network manager. We always have to thank them because they keep things functioning. Kim also has a show on Brain Injury Network. Hers shows on Wednesday night. Every night of the week there's a different show, so tune in. But we also want to let our audience know that Surviving Head Trauma is a book that can be purchased anywhere books are sold. I am the author of Surviving Head Trauma, and I write it from almost 40 years now of living with brain trauma and the experiences that we go through and overcome and work on and develop. But it's also a website, terrysmithbooks.com. You can find every episode of our podcast from, I think, maybe 6 or 7 years now. We've been on the air.
Right.
And Facebook.
Wow, it goes.
Facebook has a page, Surviving Head Trauma. Every day, you visit Surviving a Trauma on Facebook and read a little bit more about what it takes to survive head trauma and read inspiring stories. So we try to give you as much as we can from what we've learned over the years. And we've learned quite a bit. And tonight, even more so, because this is the first time I've heard someone speak ill of cannabis. The flower, giving plant is what we call it. So even there's more to learn. Yeah. So Michelle, you be careful when you're traveling, because we now see that this the world seems to be populated with all kinds of drugs that are laced with fentanyl. That's the new thing. That's why I was asking Cher so often if it was pure flour. She said it was, but fentanyl is in almost candy-like foods now and drugs. It's cut with fentanyl, so you just got to be careful out there and not do illicit drugs to start with. But even your prescription drugs can be dangerous if not taken properly or as prescribed.
Right. So anyway, be healthy, take your vitamins, drink water, and what else can you do?
The manipulatives, the brain exercises, those are imperative, it seems, because even with a strong, healthy mind, it can just slip one day into Alzheimer's land. So we can at least do our part by trying as much as possible to do the manipulatives, the crossword puzzle, the Sudoku, Sudoku. Okay.
Sudoku.
Yeah. The mind exercise puzzles, jigsaw puzzles are excellent. Also, great brain manipulatives to keep those neurons firing properly.
Right.
So we do the best we can and the most we can for as long as we can so that we don't have to one day be locked behind a gate because of Alzheimer's and the fear of us running away doing something dangerous to ourselves or someone else. But we have, I think, one more PSA from Brain Injury Association, and with only 6 minutes left, we'll take a 33-second break and hear our last message for Brain Injury Awareness Month. We'll be right back in 33 seconds.
Imagine not knowing the difference between a hairbrush, a toothbrush, or a paintbrush, or forgetting which goes on first, your shoes or your socks. More than 2.5 million children and adults sustain traumatic brain injuries in the United States each year. If you or someone close to you has experienced a brain injury, you're not alone. Get the help you need today. Call the Brain Injury Association at 1-800-444-6443 or on the web at biausa.org.
BIAUSA.org. Now, a lot of those symptoms he just described for brain trauma, like I said, are not always external forces impacting the brain. Those symptoms fit Alzheimer's, which is a trauma to the brain, but it's an acquired trauma that we grow into. So the symptoms are the same. You don't know who you are anymore or how to tie your shoelaces. So we really, really, really can't emphasize enough during Brain Injury Awareness Month to take advantage of your lucid condition while you're still thoughtful and of right mind to exercise and keep that brain active and in full function. Michelle, do you have any tips for our audience for keeping our minds sharp?
No, not right now. I'm going to save it till next week. Just go vitamin place or vitamin aisle. Maybe Google first and come up with a list of supplements for your mood and try one. That's it. Try it.
Trial and error. Whoops.
Yeah.
I took a sip of water and then I was going to choke on myself here. Excuse me. It's, I guess you're right. Okay. Trial and error is our, excuse me, our go-to because we don't have an absolute for anything and everyone handles the same medicine differently. And I can't get my mind off of this one, the medical marijuana. That 3-4 loop when Cher told me that story, that one, that one's scary because
since you're such an advocate of that product, I mean, I'm sure that kind of threw you for a loop. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tough.
We just do the best we can. The most.
How
we
doing
can.
On time?
We have 3 minutes left for our March Surviving Head Trauma on the Brain Injury Radio Network. So with that, I think we've covered Brain Injury Awareness Month to let our audience know just what's out there and what we need to do while we still can. And for all of you who are going through what Cher went through, if you're currently going through it, we have her as an example of hope that even the ending may be sad or tragic as her son died from a seizure. Going through it is tough, but there is an ending. It doesn't last forever. It goes back to nothing lasts forever. So that's I think one of my takeaways from tonight is that nothing lasts forever, no matter how hard or how good. So it's a matter of appreciating the moments we have as they happen and taking from them what we can
right.
to help us grow.
Because tomorrow is not promised. We might not make it.
This is true. This is true. But let's certainly hope that your tomorrow happens because fun and adventure awaits for your tomorrow.
Yep.
Yeah,
so 1 minute. Anything else you'd like to say?
I'd like to thank our audience because I know that we thank every month. We thank Craig and Kim and all the other hosts on Brain Injury Radio Network. And I thank you constantly for showing up each month and co-hosting the show. But we'd like to thank our audience, too, for sending in their comments and their letters, sharing their life stories with us and letting us be a part of their journey. Maybe helping share our solutions to some issues. So with that said, whether you're listening to us live or to an archived version, we appreciate you, we love you, and we certainly are here to give you the most we can to make the best of what we're going through in life. Because we are all going through something that we don't talk about, or we do talk about it, but it's painful. But we are here to help as much as possible. So thank you for tuning in and giving us that opportunity.
Right. Thank you.
Yes. And with that note, I guess it's time for us to say goodnight in 60 seconds. We have 1 minute, so 58 seconds now to sign off. On this reality, this ride through space on this big planet, our spaceship Earth, and we send you love, well-being, and health. Thank you for listening. And Michelle, thank you for joining us. And Cher Wilson, thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, her pseudonym or nom de plume for her books is Sarah Martin. So look for her books. Google Sarah Martin and find her books. All right. 20 seconds left. We can say goodnight and see you next month. The next show is going to be April April 4th, Thursday in April, which is going to be the 27th. So we'll see you next month.
Right.
April 27th. Thank you. And good night. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.